Welcome to the Pastor Bill Davis podcast series. We begin this morning with a scripture reading from the Bible, which is then followed by the Pastor Davis sermon. Thank you for joining us today.
Our scripture reading this morning is taken from the book of Mark, chapter 9, verses 2 through 9. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. This is the word of our Lord. Thanks be to God.
If you were to ask back in 1970, what country would dominate the watchmaking industry for the foreseeable future, anybody would answer Switzerland. At that time, Swiss watchmakers and clockmakers were the premium top shelf producers. And in fact, Switzerland produced at that time in 1970 about 60 to 65% of all watches in the entire world and made 90% of the profit in the world. Between that time in 1970 to 1980, those numbers almost completely reversed. Switzerland went from producing 65% of the watches to less than 20%, from making 90% of the profit to making just 10% of the profit. What happened? Why was it decimated? Well, what happened is in the 1960s, there was the invention or the development of quartz movement, the quartz watch movement. And the Swiss watchmakers could not wrap their heads around the existence of a watch that did not have a mainspring and a knob. They didn't know what to do with this new technology. Now, the ironic thing about that is that the quartz movement was developed by Swiss watchmakers and presented at a convention in 1967. But the rest of the Swiss watchmakers could not understand what to do with that movement. Now, Japan did. Seiko took over we won't get into that story, but the point is that the Swiss could not understand this new innovation, and so the world passed them by. There's a saying, a principle in the business world that says that a system that does not know what to do will do what it knows. The system that does not know what to do will do what it knows. The Swiss watchmakers didn't know what to do with this new innovation, so they said, "Well, we'll just keep doing what we know how to do. We're really good at that." And the world is littered. This is just one example of the business world that is littered with companies that once upon a time were at the top of their field, but new innovations came. And instead of renewing their vision, they didn't know what to do, and so they just kept doing what they know. What is true in the business world is true in the church as well. Society changes. Values change. Communication changes. And again, churches struggle to keep up with the new vision. We don't know what to do, so we keep doing what we know. And we hold on to outdated ministries, outdated practices, outdated modes of communication, and the world passes us by, and the landscape is littered with churches, great big churches that once upon a time were full and now are half full at best, struggling to hold on. Because when they didn't know what to do with the new things that were happening in the world around them, they just kept doing what they knew. It happens in business, it happens in churches, it happens for us as individuals. Many of us, some here today, are stuck in what we call ruts because we can't have a vision, we can't grasp the new thing that God is calling us to do, so we just keep doing what we know. People are stuck in dead-end jobs because when God gives them a vision to step out in faith and to see something new, they can't wrap their heads around that new vision, so they just keep doing what they know. There are people who are stuck in unhealthy and even abusive relationships because they can't catch a vision of the possibilities of stepping out in faith. You don't know what to do, you keep doing what you know, even if that means hunkering down and enduring the pain. So we come to our passage this morning, Mark chapter 9. And Jesus has invited three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, up to a mountain. And when they are on the mountain, Christ is transfigured before them, or transformed, clothed in light so bright that it is dazzling, they can't even look at it. And Peter doesn't know what to do. And so he does what he knows. Let's build a monument here. Now think about the context here. This is after 3 years of following Christ in his ministry. This is at the end, Mark chapter 9. Jesus, in the previous chapter, Mark chapter 8, has just predicted his death and says, this is what I'm progressing toward. In the very next chapter, chapter 10, Jesus starts his final journey into Jerusalem, where he'll be arrested and murdered. And so here in Mark chapter 9, these disciples have been with him for the 3 years of his earthly ministry. Think of the incredible things they've seen. They've seen Jesus perform healings, restore sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf. They've seen him cast out demons. They've seen him feed the multitudes miraculously. They've seen him walk on water. But they've never seen anything like this. They've never seen Jesus transfigured. And so it says that they were afraid and overwhelmed. And Mark says they didn't know what to do. And so what do? They do what they know. Peter is not coming up with some silly idea here when he says, let's build dwellings, let's build a monument. This is what the people of God have done for centuries, millennia at this point. You think of how many times in the Old Testament, when God does a great miraculous thing for his people, he says, you need to remember this. Build an altar here. Build a temple. Build just a monument. The Hebrew word is Ebenezer, a stone of hope or stone of help. It can be translated either way, but it means build a monument here. When the Israelites crossed the Jordan into the promised land, Joshua instructed them, build a monument, an Ebenezer here, so that in centuries and in generations to come, your children will look at this monument and say, what happened here? You'll be able to explain what God has done. So Peter is not coming up with some half-baked idea that no one's ever seen before. He's reverting back to what he knows how to do. And God speaks out of the cloud and says, I don't want you to do that. This is the fulfillment of the promise in the Old Testament that someday the law of God will not be written in stone, but in your heart. And Christ fulfills that. We don't want a stone monument. We want you to remember in your heart what God has done and what God is doing in the people of this earth. And Peter does remember that. If you look at Peter's second epistle, 2 Peter chapter 1, he refers to this event, starting in verse 16. He says, we're not just making up fables here and clever stories. I'm telling you what I saw on the mountaintop. Christ was transfigured, and we saw his glory. And he transformed my life, and he can transform your life as well. We need, as the people of God, we need as humans, these Ebenezers, these stones of hope, these monuments that remind us of the greatness of God and his love and his mercy and his grace extended to people. We need to be reminded of that because it's easy to forget when we walk out these doors into a troubled world. And so we have in the church monuments, holidays, holy days, get back to the original meaning of that word, that stand as Ebenezers, not stone, but reminders of what God has done for us and what God wants to do in us today. One of those monuments is Lent, the season of Lent that starts this Wednesday, on Ash Wednesday. Actually the biggest, not in terms of popularity, but the biggest holiday in terms of its duration. 46 days. We often say 40 days. I was corrected about this. I one time was talking with other clergy and said Lent is Of course, 40 days where we joined Christ symbolically in his 40-day fast in the desert. And one of my fellow pastors said, it's actually 46 days. We often say it's 40 days, not including Sundays. Actually, it's 40 days and plus six Sundays. But the Sundays are not included in the penitent fasting part. Sundays are always a day of celebration in the Christian church. Every year at about this time of year, I remind the people congregated here that every Sunday is Easter Sunday. Share that with your friends so they don't just come once a year. Every Sunday is Easter Sunday in the church when we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So it's 40 days of fasting plus 6 days of celebration to remind us why we're fasting. What's the point of fasting if you fast? I'm saying that as if everyone does that. Not everybody does, and that's okay. We fast as a tradition of the church. It's not commanded in the Bible, but it's something that the people of God have found helpful in preparing for Easter. I find it helpful to remind people that God expects us to fast. Jesus fasted. He instructed his disciples how to do it. In our society, Western society, we've gotten kind of spoiled to the point that we don't often do that. We don't fast anymore like we used to in the church. Lent is a time to remind you of the importance of this practice, this tradition. It's two things that fasting will do, giving something up. How many people give something up? Well, no, don't raise your hand. I'm not going to ask you to do that. But how many people remember, if you grew up in the church, you remember you were encouraged to give up candy or chocolate or something like that, and you grew up and you wonder why you do that? Well, the reason we do that is that fasting does two things. One, it reminds us of just how selfish we are. We don't like to think of ourselves as selfish, most of us. Even non-Christians don't, unless you're Gordon Gekko. Anybody remember 1980s? Not in the 1980s, but that Wall Street movie with Michael Douglas. Nobody? Somebody is admitting to watching it. Michael Douglas starred in this movie called Wall Street as this Wall Street financier named Gordon Gekko, who his famous line was, "Greed is good." And I want to remind you that most people don't believe that. Gordon Gekko was the villain of that movie. Even the world recognizes that we ought to be selfless, giving, gracious, generous. And we like to think of ourselves that way. What fasting does, it reminds us that we're not as good as we like to think we are. Give up chocolate, give up soda, give up sugar, whatever it is you're giving up. And it seems like such a small thing until you're about 2 weeks into fasting. And all of a sudden, that one little thing you gave up is the one thing you must have. Why? Because we are selfish. We are selfish and we pamper ourselves and we don't like to sacrifice even a little thing. Even a little thing. Fasting reminds us of the fact that we're not as good as we like to think we are. And we spend our lives pampering our physical bodies, pursuing any earthly thing we want, while ignoring our spiritual needs. That's the second thing that we do, or that we learn from fasting, is it helps us to sort of balance the scales. We spend our lives pursuing whatever earthly thing we want while starving our spirit. How many people are excited? I hear there's some sort of game going on today, some sort of sport ball event is taking place today. How many people are excited about the Super Bowl? You're going to have a party and you're looking forward to watching hours you're going to spend watching the game and laughing at the commercials. Now, how many people are excited or were excited to get up and come to church this morning? You see, the problem is that we pursue the stuff of this world. Some people raise their hands. Thank you. They're in the back row raising their hands. We're excited to be about church. But we are excited and we spend hours, not just today, but day after day, feeding every earthly thing we want. When it comes to feeding our spiritual needs, well, it's such an effort. Such an effort, so hard. And then we wonder why we are so spiritually weak. After feeding our earthly body everything it wants, it is so easy to be angry, to be impatient, to join in the conflict of the world, and it's so hard to be loving and peacemakers and to have hope. And we wonder why. Well, because we feed our earthly needs and we starve our spirit. Fasting encourages us to balance the scales a little bit. So you don't have to fast for Lent. I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on you. Well, maybe a little bit, I'm trying to. But mostly, I'm just saying that take it seriously. Don't just cast it off as some relic of the past. This is a stone of hope, a reminder of something holy that should be taking place and could be taking place in our lives. And so we need these reminders, as Peter recognizes, and as we remember here on Transfiguration Sunday, Christ was transfigured. What do we learn from the transfiguration here in Mark chapter 9? First of all, that Christ, who was transfigured, also desires to transfigure or transform our lives as well. Paul, writing to the church at Rome, says that the walk of discipleship is about this, that we are transformed by the renewing of our minds. And Peter's transformed by this experience. And we come here on Transfiguration Sunday not just to remember that 2,000 years ago some crazy wild thing happened on a mountain in Israel, but the transfigured Christ meets us here, promises to meet us here in our gathering to transform and transfigure our lives. One of the roles of the church is to encourage you to recognize the presence of God in your life. If you came into this church this morning and you came in here worried, full of anxiety about the stresses in your life, you can come in here and encounter Jesus Christ, who is your provider, who reminds you that God has you in the palm of his hand and walks with you in the good times by the green valleys and also in the valley of the shadow of death. If I came in here today and I am full of bitterness and anger because of what I've just seen on some ridiculous cable propaganda show, I encounter a Christ who calls me to be a peacemaker, to walk out of here and not speak words of anger and bitterness, but instead speak words of grace and reconciliation. If you come in here today and you're just in a time of grief, in a time of loss, and you feel overwhelmed by the sadness, encounter Christ, the transfigured Christ, who comes and says, our God is the Father of compassion, the God of all comfort. And you can speak peace and strength into your heart. If I come in here today and I'm full of greed and lust for the people and the things of this world, I am called out by the Spirit of God to see my fellow humans as souls created in the image of God, who I'm called to love and build up and encourage. If you come in here today and you're just tired, anybody just tired of the strife and the situation in this world, then encounter the transfigured Christ who says, I can give you strength and you can do all things. To the Christ who strengthens you. You can go on in the list, but you get the idea that God is a transforming God at the individual level and at the world level. There's a professor, or was, passed away now, but Yaroslav Pelikan was for decades, a professor of history at Yale University and one of the leading scholars in our country. He founded the Council of Scholars at the Library of Congress, so a very intelligent man and into history. And he did a study on the impact of Jesus Christ on Western civilization. And he said that every country in Western civilization since Constantine has been profoundly impacted by Christ. I'm not going to go into spend a lot of time on the details, but he said you can trace throughout the history of Western civilization that even countries that we would say were oppressive tried to justify what they were doing, were restrained somewhat by the need to justify how they were following Christ in some way. Those who were poor and weak at the other end of the spectrum were called by Christ, were compelled by Christ to stand up and fight injustice. The same Christ who compels the powerful to be peaceful and gracious and generous in power calls the poor and oppressed to rise up and fight evil injustice in the world. And Pelikan said that some people can look at that and say, well, you see how Christ is twisted in each society. But he said, here's what I believe, that Christ transforms every society. What we learn at the transfiguration of Christ is that he is not just the master of the Jews in Palestine at that time, but the transforming, transfiguring force for all who open their hearts and minds to receive him at every level. At every level, the call of the church is to go out into a world that is full of chaos and brokenness and speak peace to the chaos, and healing to the broken. It's a high calling that the transfigured Christ has placed on his people. It's a difficult calling. Notice in this passage that Peter and the disciples want to stay on the mountaintop. We all want to stay on the mountaintop. Jesus doesn't let them. He brings them down into the valley. And our passage ends in verse 9. If you read on in Mark chapter 9, Mark 9 ending in verse 9. But if you read that chapter 9 beyond verse 9, you see that Jesus leads the people down from the mountain. And what do they encounter? The very first thing they encounter at the bottom of the mountain is people arguing. Imagine that. People arguing and fighting to the point that Jesus himself, in verse 19, if you ever felt worn out, Jesus himself in verse 19 says, "How much longer must I put up with you?" You don't think of Jesus saying that very often, but he says it in verse 19 of Mark 9, "How much longer must I put up with this?" It's hard calling to be loving and gracious and forgiving people in a world that is often the opposite. One example I have given, I know before, about the difficulty of being forgiving people. There was a man named Simon Wiesenthal. Wiesenthal was a Holocaust survivor. He and his wife spent years in the concentration camp at Lemberg. They both survived. His wife never fully physically recovered. They lost dozens of their family. And Wiesenthal tells this story, and he says that one day when he was working, and he always worked hard because those who didn't were the ones who were killed. So he was working hard, and he was working at this converted Nazi military hospital. And as he was working one day, a nurse came out and grabbed him by the shoulder, just dragged him into the hospital, put him into a room, and said, "You need to talk to this man." Wiesenthal found himself in a room with a Nazi soldier. Clearly in desperate straits, soon to die. He would, in fact, die the next day. But as Wiesenthal came to the side of the bed, this soldier said, "I've done horrible things. I've done horrible things to your people." He told awful stories, culminating with this one time we put 300 Jews in a building and set it on fire. And me and my comrades surrounded that building. Anybody who came out, we shot. "I've done horrible things. I feel terrible. I'm overcome with guilt. I know I'm about to die, and I need to be forgiven. You're a Jew. Will you forgive me?" Wiesenthal was overwhelmed, didn't know what to say. And what do you do when you don't know what to do? You do what you know. He turned around without saying anything, went back to work, kept his head down, hoped not to be noticed. That was what he knew to do. But that incident tormented him for years. Afterwards, he sent out letters to people all around the world, to over 50, or he received 50 responses, but sent out letters to people who were theologians, philosophers, fellow Holocaust survivors, Nazis. And he asked them a simple question: "What should I have done? What would you do in that situation?" All kinds of responses. It's very interesting. You can read this in the book called The Sunflower. The first half of the book is Wiesenthal telling the story that I just summarized very briefly. The second half of the book is the responses that he got back. They're fascinating to read. Some people thought he should forgive. Most should not, for valid reasons. "How can you speak for all the Jews?" some said. Or this question itself was one more abuse that this oppressor, after abusing people for years, now wants the abused to offer him solace. Don't do it. But there was one really fascinating letter written back, Father Edward Flannery, a Catholic priest who, even before the Holocaust and in World War II, was a proponent of reconciliation between Jews and Christians primarily, but people in general. And after World War II, Father Flannery was a harsh critic of the church for remaining silent too often during what was going on. He criticized the church in general, Catholic Church in particular, not because he was bashing Catholics, but because he was himself Catholic, and so he targeted his own. But anyway, he wrote back a letter, and he said, "I acknowledge, first of all, that I can't tell you what you should have done. That was a horrible situation. All I can say is that for myself, as a Christian, I'm a follower of a man, Jesus Christ, who, when he was being nailed to a cross, said, 'Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.' And as a follower of him, as hard as it would be, I can do nothing but offer forgiveness to others, the same forgiveness that I received undeserved from Jesus Christ? Now, I'm not giving you a definitive answer to that question. That's not my purpose here. I raise it up simply as an example of the fact that the call to follow Jesus Christ is hard. It is hard. And we forget that sometimes here in our pampered American society. Sometimes, you know, I don't talk about politics a lot. If you're a regular here, you know that, at least not directly. I talk about it a little bit. But I've sometimes been criticized for that. Honestly, I've had people say, you need to get involved, that you don't take sin seriously enough if you're not telling us what you think we should do and who we should vote for. Here's my response. Friends, if you think that the solution to sin in the world, to evil in the world, is electing the right person, you're the one who's not taking sin seriously enough. If the church believes that the way that we fight evil and injustice is to pass laws, we're not taking sin seriously enough. If you want to deal with the evil and injustice in this world, we need to encounter a transfigured Christ who transfigures us and calls us to radical forgiveness of those who have done us wrong, who calls us to unwavering love in the face of a world that is full of hate and bitterness, who calls us to cling to hope when everyone else is losing theirs. If the people of God would do that, then we've seen again and again that God has the power to transfigure us and our society. It's hard, and that's why we don't do it very well. Frankly, the church fails very often. The reason the church fails very often is because it's full of you and me. And we all fall short of the glory of God. We are the church. But we were reminded of it, the transfiguration, is that when we get it right, when we offer unconditional love and grace and mercy, to the degree that we do that, we are transformed and the people around us can be transformed. Jesus calls the people down off of the mountain to get to work declaring the goodness of God. And it is hard and it takes preparation. That's why we have monuments like Lent and other holy days. That's why we come to church every week to find strength to do this. Notice the very last verse that we read, verse 9, Jesus tells the disciples, don't tell anybody what you've seen. It's not the only time Jesus says that. If you've read the Gospels, you know several times. He'll tell them, don't tell people yet. Why? He says in Mark 9, because you haven't seen what this is all about. You haven't seen the death and resurrection. You haven't seen the sacrifice that is required. If you don't know what you're talking about, here's a novel idea, don't talk. You ever met people in your life, there's an old saying that some people, they're not always right, but they're never in doubt. Have people like that in your life, they're not always right, but they're never in doubt. Maybe sometimes we are that person. We don't know what we're talking about, but that doesn't stop us from talking. Jesus here says, I'm calling you as my followers to have a little more discretion. There will be a time to speak up and share what you've seen, but until you understand the sacrifice and the love and the forgiveness that is part of the gospel of Jesus Christ, until you're ready to walk the walk, so to speak, it's better not to talk the talk. And our call as Christians is to be reminded of what it means to be a follower of a martyr who's willing to lay down his life for the good of those around him. When we can do that, to the degree that we do that, people will see the presence of God in our lives. There's a picture I'd like to show you. It's a famous picture by a very famous photographer, Josef Karsch. Josef Karsch, for the last half of the last century, was one of the most famous photographers in the world. There are many, you may not recognize the name Josef Karsch, but you've seen his pictures before. If you Google Winston Churchill, the most famous picture of him is one taken by Josef Karsch, and he traveled the world taking pictures of celebrities and statesmen and world leaders, and there is one picture, this one, it's the only one of his pictures that is taken of someone's back. And that, okay, keep into the screen back there, but that is the picture of Pablo Casals. Pablo Casals, during his life, was arguably the greatest cellist in the world, at least of his time. He was also a champion of democracy. After World War II, after the Spanish Civil War, while other countries were promoting democracy, Spain became a dictatorship under Francisco Franco. And at that time, Pablo Casals left Spain rather than be arrested or face any retribution from Franco. He left Spain and he vowed, I will never go back to my home country until the dictatorship is overthrown. And he spent almost four decades traveling the world, never did go back to Spain. Tragically, he passed away just 2 years before Spain became a democracy. But during that year, he traveled the world making beautiful music and championing democracy. And so that is why Josef Karsh wanted to take this picture of him. And he arrived at it's a little abbey in France. And the people said, just follow the music. He's playing his cello. So he did. And he came upon him in this little room facing the other way. And overwhelmed by the beauty of the music, Karsh stopped and took that picture before he took the formal portraits. He said, this became my favorite picture. And by far the favorite picture in all my displays of this little old man bent over his cello, making beautiful music. And he said, my favorite story is when this was on display in Boston at the Museum of Fine Arts, there was a man who came and he stood day after day for hours just staring at that picture until the curator of the museum came up and said, what do you think of that picture? It's nice, isn't it? And the man said, hush, shh, I'm listening to the music. The power of that portrait. I can see, I can hear, I can feel what is happening. Friends, that is our call. That's an illustration of our call as followers of Jesus Christ. The people look at our lives and they hear the music without us getting up in their face and being judgmental and condemning of the sin in the world, simply demonstrating the beauty of Christ in our lives. In a moment, we're going to sing one of my favorite hymns of the church, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. It was written by a man named Robert Robinson. Robert Robinson lived in London back when the Methodist Church was just coming into being. His family was poor. When his father died when he was 8 years old, his mother did her best to provide for the family, but it became too much. And Robert Robinson was kicked out of the home when he was 14 years old, living on the streets of London. He fell in with, as you can say, a rough crowd of other orphans trying to survive on the streets. One day, George Whitefield, one of the great Methodist preachers of all time, this was when Wesley was founding the Methodist Church, and if there was one Methodist preacher who was just as popular as Wesley, in fact, probably more popular, it was George Whitefield. And he came to preach in London. And Robert Robinson and his friends went to the rally not to see George Whitefield, but to heckle Whitefield. They caused a disturbance so they could maybe pick some pockets. But as Whitefield spoke, the Spirit of God moved on the heart of Robert Robinson. And he converted to Christianity at that rally, became a Methodist preacher himself. And years later, he wrote this great hymn, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. Teach my heart to sing thy praise. It's a prayer to make my life a song that people can hear. And he acknowledges, one of the reasons I like this song is he acknowledges in the last verse how hard it is. He lived a wild life and he continued to like wild things. And he wrestled with that his entire life. And in that last stanza of the song, he says, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. But right in the middle of the song, he says, here's how I combat that. I raise an Ebenezer. Hither by thy help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. It's the role of the church to raise an Ebenezer, to be a monument to the greatness of God that can do great things through humble people like us and humble churches like this. So let's sing that song together as a response to the scripture this morning, as our commitment that as we leave from here, we will be that stone of hope, that stone of help, that people will see and be drawn to the music of Jesus Christ in our lives. So the singer's going to come to lead us, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing.